The following program is rated M16+. Parental guidance recommended. It contains strong themed topics, drug use, alcohol use, violence and self-harm.
Welcome to Bounce Back. My name's Yvonne Fletcher from NY Events and you're listening into DRN1. Bounce Back's a fun talkback show and we're focusing on WA Mental Health Week. I have in the studio right now Wurzel. I'm not going to say it properly.
Oh, Wurzel Montague.
I knew it.
Wurzel is fine. It's like Madonna. We can do just a one name.
Wurzel, do you know what happened in my head then? It became scrambled eggs and my tongue could not work.
That's fine. No, it is. If you're unfamiliar with the name, I get it all the time. In many ways, like, you know, the whole story out of New South Wales with Gladys. I'm not even trying to say her last name.
We know her as Gladys. It's all right. Yeah.
I still, there's a childish little boy in me that still refers to her as Glad Wrap Barbecue Chicken just because I'm so embarrassed of my inability to say her last name. And I've had people explain it to me and I've sounded out for me and I've gone, anyway. It's not so I get it.
Thank you for being forgiving.
No problem.
Wurzel, basically we're here to have a bit of a chat about mental health and also we both have children on the spectrum, so we're going to have a bit of a chat about that as well. Where did you want to start? Do you want to start with children on the spectrum or would you like to start with mental health?
Wow, it's kind of – it sort of all sits within one umbrella for me. My family, by which I mean ancestrally, like my parents and grandparents' generation, and I mean my extended family in terms of nieces, nephews, cousins, my siblings, is just a hot soup of what I broadly label neurodiversity, by which I mean, and some people would delineate that between sort of mental illness conditions and other things like autism spectrum disorder, which I would call neurodiversity. For me, because things like bipolar disorder are very common in my family, and other diagnoses of psychotic type illnesses like schizophrenia and affective schizoid disorder. Suicidiation is a big thing in my family. And the autism spectrum disorder is all over the shop in my family. In some places diagnosed, in other places not, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, I don't really... at a personal level. So I'm a trainer in these areas. I teach a variety of topics from things like very practical things like mental health first aid, but I also run courses on a topic like, say, understanding personality disorders or understanding dissociative disorders, or where I kind of drill down on a specific category of conditions. But for me, at least... And it's helpful out there because people do have different language about these things, but I don't see these things as so different. To me, it's and this is such a simplistic analogy, but for me it's left-handedness, right? So it's just a thing that the X percent, I think it's about 11-12% of the population, are wired in a way that their left hand is dominant. And once upon a time, our culture used to say that's wrong, it's bad. Kids who want to use their left hand to write, we need to tie their left hand behind their back and we need to, we need to make them culturally normative, right? And I just hate that idea of what's culturally normative, full stop. Yes, like coming back to kids on the spectrum, like kids should be able to lead a full life. And if that involves, for a kid like mine, his challenge is communication and language and interpreting language from others. So, yeah, like I really hope, he gets all the right opportunities in his young life to sort of overcome those barriers in particular. But do I think the world, that he needs to learn to be, to show the right manners or the right kind of level of eye contact or the right, no. Like, we're all incredibly different. And certainly in my life, and maybe because I grew up in a family that was, in some ways a bit unstable and dysfunctional and, had a dad who was a bit of an emotional terrorist. The poor fella had some undiagnosed, pretty severe stuff going on, which wasn't diagnosed till later in life. So, pretty scary times, violent environment. So I grew up a full-on people pleaser, like always wanting to be the person in the space made everyone else feel okay.
Yeah.
And God, that was exhausting. God, so exhausting. And I look at my son, not quite six, who doesn't give a shit, just does not give a shit. We'll just blank you and walk off on you. Because he's a cute little kid, right? And all the neurotypicals want to approach him and say, hello, what's your name? How old are you? What's your favorite color? And he just... doesn't, like, just not even, he's not, it's just not ignoring them, they're just, it's just a thing that happens, like a dog barking for him, and he just walks away from them. And they're so shocked and outraged and looked at me and going, you're going to apologise for your rude child? And I'm like, no, I'm not. I am so – I admire the shit out of his boundaries and priorities. So it's a – you know.
I so, Wurzel, is your child that's on the spectrum, is that the six-year-old or?
Yeah, that's he's he's not quite six. He's going through pre-primary at the moment in a beautiful little school that's really good for him. So I have a daughter – almost 21. I don't think she'd mind me saying in a public forum like this that she got another lot of my dodgy genes, and that she's got bipolar disorder like me. Yeah. So there was another set of challenges there. So, you know, in some ways, her childhood was pretty cruisy in her early adolescence. Then, you know, good old bipolar disorder, you know, dumped on her like a ton of bricks in her late adolescence. So, you know, different challenges, and that's, you know, that's just the glorious gene pool I'm from.
There's definitely a genetic component to it, that's for sure. So two of my boys have autism and ADHD. And
both kind of like co-diagnoses?
Yeah, the comorbidity thing.
Yeah.
So basically one of my children also suffers from mental health issues, and myself that got me involved in a project which I know I've shared with you, which is a Thousand Flower Project. And basically we're trying to bridge a gap between our public health system, where there is no mental health services available for children or adolescents or adults that are on the spectrum. They see them as two totally separate things, which is okay. Yep. They are two totally different things.
No, but they're so not.
But yeah, I really like, I've been begging for mental health support for my son, and basically I feel like a lot of families are drowning out there because there is lack of support for children and adolescents that are on the spectrum.
Oh, it's 100%. And we could say, generally speaking, that our education models, our health models, they there are good people inside these things doing the best they can, right, with the system that's there and what they've got. So not to hang shit on any individual teacher, practitioner, nurse, you know, social worker, specialist, doctor, inside the system, but our system, our Western way, is so not holistic, right? It so just puts everything in boxes and categories. It's a bit like if we were to step outside and look at, say, something like trying to help addicts recover, for example.
Yeah.
Like if you're working with someone trying to get them off whatever it is, booze, meth, whatever their thing is that's messing their life up, and they want to recover from the use of. If you're not looking at, you know, do they have any significant trauma in their past that they're recovering from? Do they have any underlying mental health conditions, like, you know, kind of genetic predisposition towards, you know, are they living in chronic pain because of some sort of discovered physical illness? Are they, you know, you've got to look at the whole picture, the whole person. Are they living in stable housing? Do they have a job? Do they have – if you don't look at the entire picture of a person's life – pardon me, there's been whacking the microphone. that's my, you know, talking my hands Mediterranean style. but, yeah, it's just and that whole thing about where the you know, where the autism spectrum crosses over with a whole bunch of other stuff. And it's so, you know, one of my favourite mentors, she's actually my boss, you know, she often says to me, look, the DSM-5 is, you know, which is still the Bible for, you know, categorising people with kind of whatever it is, neurodiversity or psychological kind of conditions or whatever else. She said often it's just looking at a bunch of symptoms, drawing a circle around them and go, these symptoms co-occur enough to be able to kind of consider this a thing.
Yeah.
But I think humans are so diverse, and there is absolute evidence and research, for example, to show that people on the spectrum are far, far more likely in terms of prevalence percentage to transition gender at some point in their life. So it's there's all these factors and dynamics at play that we don't. So anyway, I'm banging on far too much because I find this stuff interesting.
But it is interesting.
But good on you for, like, trying to, you know, working and advocating. Like, we need spectrum-informed mental health services and mental health-informed spectrum services.
Absolutely. And I don't mind if people acknowledge that they're two totally different – they need two separate therapies, actually. Mm. I've been told, you know, you can over-therapeutize someone. I'm like, hang on, no, they're two separate issues. Mm-hmm. Let's treat them separately. And then sometimes they do blend and mould into each other, as you know. So,
well, the practical skills that help people apply, here's the thing. So I teach a lot. So I'm bipolar, so I'm very, very interested in emotional regulation skills, right, through various therapy modes and whatever else. But, and I don't care how people get to them, whether they, you know, learn meditation or they, whatever there is. But every human being needs to be self-aware about our emotions and needs to be responsible for regulating our own emotions, right? Now, if you're on the autism spectrum, there is a higher likelihood that you'll, experience difficulties in emotional regulation. If you've got a condition like depression or anxiety or these really high occurring things in society, then emotional regulation is like the key issue to trying to recover and live well with those things. In some forms. And there's different modes. So, you know, generally speaking, a person with depression, you know, their emotional regulation will respond well to medication, whereas a person on the autism spectrum, you know, medication is probably not going to help them regulate their emotions. So there's differences, but the principles are the same and the practical skills are the same. And the, I think when we get to a point where people walk around in day-to-day lives less trying to diagnose everybody and more saying, I reckon my friend there, there's someone who's really struggling with emotional regulation stuff, you know. I wonder if they're talking to somebody about what might work for them. And actually kind of more of a first aid mindset, like identifying people's kind of needs and challenges, rather than kind of going, oh, I reckon you've got, you know, X disorder or you've got blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, we all want to play kind of quack.
Yeah, Dr. Google.
Yeah. Instead of actually going, you know. It's considering ourselves, what do I need? What are my challenges in day-to-day life? And for our friends and family members and loved ones and everyone we meet, you know, looking at people going, huh, you seem to be someone who lacks, I don't know, you know, is spatial awareness a regular thing you have, or you just crash your car a lot or whatever?
With yourself as bipolar, what age were you diagnosed?
I was not diagnosed until after my first marriage blew up, which was kind of a bit of a in my early 30s. That was the was the incentive to kind of go, oh, something's up with me. In my 20s, I was treated for depression, and I very much thought of myself as a depressive, and I knew that I'd struggled with suicidation and morbid depression and all the kind of consequences of that. So, but I'd never figured out the other side of the story until it was diagnosed by a psychiatrist in my early 30s, and finding out was such a liberation. But that said, working with various specialists and whatever else along the way and looking back at my childhood, I was probably one of those really rare examples of it manifesting really early in life. So bipolar usually only comes on in adolescence or later, or early adulthood. With me, the best we can figure out is I first showed really significant symptoms around 7 years of age. That was the first time in my life where I expressed strong suicidal urges.
To your parents? Or?
Yeah, to my mum at that point, actually. Yeah. And so, but then there was a heap of other stuff too, a heap of other symptomatic behaviour that, my story as a kid, I was basically the perfect kid who tried to be the best boy possible and please everybody and do really well at school a lot of the time, and the rest of the time I was either incredibly, you know, incredibly sad and or I was, you know, off the walls. But I also, unlike a lot of kids, I didn't act out in front of people very often. So I would go off, you know, I was blessed to live between the outer suburbs of Perth and a farm in the wheat belt, so I would go off and do the crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of unseen, largely. It was only after, you know, yeah, the consequences of that, like, you know, I'd hurt myself doing something crazy or some risk-taking behaviour and, you know. But anyway, so by the time I was diagnosed, it was a relief because I'd only ever thought of myself as a depressive who would occasionally do really dumb, out-of-character stuff.
Yeah,
and get my life into trouble, and you know, kind of have the shame of digging myself out of whatever it was, you know, acting in a way that really hurt someone I loved, or getting into a crazy amount of debt, or doing the other kind of, you know, going on a drug or drink bender, or the other kinds of behaviour that are quite common with bipolar or people having a manic episode.
Yeah, how do you manage it now then?
Holistically, I'm really, so medication is an absolute bedrock for bipolar, and I am very fortunate after years and years of searching and getting it right to have got on a prescription that I began with a really forward-thinking psychiatrist who suggested that I might be one of the bipolar folks who responds really well to anticonvulsants, originally designed for epilepsy as a mood stabilizer. Yeah. So lithium is still the gold. So mood stabilizers are really important for bipolar.
Yeah.
Really important, more important than anything. But and the gold standard for them is still lithium. But people who, and anyone out there who's, you know, on lithium or who's got a psychiatrist saying, suggesting they should take it, you know, take it. It's far better than, you know, living with unmedicated, untreated bipolar disorder. But for me, at least, I'm very fortunate in that, yes, an anti-epilepsy, anti-convulsant drug is giving me, you know, really great mood stabilization without a lot of nasty side effects. It's not killing my kidneys. It's not, you know, doing a bunch of stuff that strong mood stabilizers can. So,
What's some of your coping strategies then?
For me, it's all so I live utterly sober these days. So in that, and I mean that to mean I don't drink, I don't do recreational drugs like I once did. I'm very, very, I'm almost, my ex-partner, my son's mum, she's very, she openly mocks me. I'm very slow to take Panadol for a headache. I'm very slow to put anything into my body that, having said that, I vape nicotine and I drink a lot of coffee. But other than that, very, very – anything that affects my perception of myself, even my pain threshold. Generally speaking, unless I've got a crushing migraine that's like putting me in bed for 4 days, if I'm feeling pain, I want to feel it because I want to know where my body is. Because for me, my experience of bipolar is very physiological early on. So when I'm depressed, I will notice that first and my body starts to ache, like I haven't had enough sleep, even though I'm having a lot of sleep. Or I will notice myself getting up towards hypomanic, which is kind of the stage before mania, when I'm bouncing out of bed feeling amazing and having lots of energy. And that's when I kind of go, uh-oh. So it's I call it keeping the gauges clear, but which I mean like monitoring the gauges in a car, like where's the temperature at, where's the oil pressure at. So I have to know. So, yes, I watch my emotions. You know, what's a day where I'm quick to anger, I'm very irritated or whatever else, but that to me is much less reliable than what my body's doing. And that's something I teach a lot in emotional regulation stuff that, you know, I think, again, Western society, we're such idiots. We've produced this paradigm that that willpower is the key to everything. Like you think yourself into feeling a certain way or behaving a certain way. To me, it's like, no. Get your body calm first. Get your body calm, breathe, oxygenate. If you have too much excess energy, expend it in a healthy way, doing some exercise or whatever it is. Get your body to a state of calm, and then the emotional self follows, and then the mental self follows. That's very much mine. So it's being aware of my physical self all the time. You know, do I need to sit still and breathe and meditate for a while, or do I need to stand up and have a dance or burn off some adrenaline or whatever it is, and keep my body in a state of get. Plenty of good sleep. Sleep hygiene is huge. One of my favorite teachers on bipolar disorder, a researcher, says that it should be first and foremost understood as a sleep disorder.
Because you don't get enough sleep or you get too much sleep? What's
both at both ends.
Okay.
And it is very influenced by broadly speaking, the research shows that if you're someone who really, and this was always me, my sleep was always erratic. So I would be someone who would party hard all week and have far too little sleep and then like sleep for 16 hours at a time to thinking like that was good to catch up, right? To like repay the sleep there. That's a terrible lifestyle for a bipolar person because you're just messing up your circadian rhythm constantly. Mm-hmm. If you're bipolar, and it's so boring, people don't like hearing this because bipolar people generally we'd like to be dynamic and party and get out there and we do extraordinary stuff, right? Like so a lot of the bipolar people are the most creative, entrepreneurial kind of, you know, But I know for me, absolutely, and the research backs this up, you've got to be as boring as possible, have a set bedtime, have a set wake-up time, have a routine, like, and I spent years resisting routine.
So routine and structure is really good.
It's really good for me. Like, I don't and I used to think that was the death of creativity. It was the death of, I just thought that was what boring
is. Okay, I've got to ask, has it been then?
It's been amazing because it's improved my health and my general well-being and my general sense of calm. And when I'm healthy and my well-being's good and I'm calm, then I'm more creative and I'm more productive and I'm more...
That's really positive.
Yeah. It's taken me a long time to get there, though. Like, I'm within spitting distance of 50 now. I'll be 48 in January, and it's taken me an embarrassingly long time to learn these kind of lessons. You know, I think I had a very delayed adolescence going, not going to bed, you know. I think I still had that well and truly into my late 30s, you know, this kind of, not the boss of me. So, Yeah, and it's all the boring stuff, all the stuff that's, you know, your GP tells you from day dot, you know, just eat well, get some vegetables, make sure, you know, you've got enough nutrients in your body, all that kind of, you know.
Yeah.
So, and I'm pretty lucky, particularly now I've got my weight down a bit. I used to carry far, far too much weight, but now that I'm relatively healthy, I'm in a good time point of life in terms of, and it's all those things, hormone levels, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And if you've got the right level of iron in your blood, all that, if you've got all that business working, your pituitary gland's okay, and all that, so the body is such a complex, you know, series of systems and networks. And if you can get those things as balanced as possible, then whatever glitchy stuff you're kind of, the wiring of your brain and nervous system is doing, you can accommodate that a bit. Like, you know, and that's the way I kind of look at it now. I sort of observe the glitches and go, oh, there it is. It's like likely to cause a problem, you know. So there's one bad day where I've been grumpy and having a lot of negative thoughts. Is that just and it's trying to be self-aware enough to go, okay, so I'll clock that. I'll be aware of it. I'll go to sleep tonight, make sure I get a good night's sleep. I'll do all the right things, you know, have a nice hot shower, do whatever cup of tea, whatever my things are that kind of, you know, these routines and rituals to reset. And then let's wake up tomorrow morning, see where we're at, you know, compare that in the mood journal, you know, and that gives me the peace of mind to go, oh, you know what, Thursday was just a shitty day. Like I was just,
yeah,
you know, I was just a person having a shitty day where I was moody, and that's it.
There's so much I'm liking with what you're saying, and I'm sorry, we've probably got 20 questions going on here.
Sure.
I like that you're very self-aware, but you're also very good at regulating self. But you just said then a mood journal. So do you keep a mood journal and document? Yeah,
not nearly as accurately as I should. I've got my mood journal down to like a line.
And
literally, so it's like a. Once upon a time, there's probably a lot to be said for, like, you know, quite a lengthy mood journal. It talks about things like, you know, and probably early in the process of keeping a mood journal, it's probably good to go, how much exercise did I do this day? How much, you know, did I feel stressed at work? You kind of keep note of all that. Whereas I literally now just, it's an old exercise book.
Yeah.
Like, so it's literally just one line per day with a date. And I literally just draw a little line, which is kind of, it's a short, no one else could make sense of it. But for me, it represents like a little graph of the day. You know, I just kind of, it's a code I can read. So, you know, a level line is the best thing I can put in there.
Mm.
That's kind of a, you know, otherwise, you know, you know, a kind of increasing line is kind of like elation, like, you know, that was a particularly good part of the day, like, you know, I was excited or I was blah, 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 blah. And again, that might be a healthy thing.
Yeah.
Or it might be a sign of, you know, if I look down and go, whoa, I've had six elated days in a row, that's probably a warning sign. Life's either going particularly well right now or, you know, there's something to watch out for.
Yeah.
Or again, yeah, and I have certain squiggles, you know, and certain kind of marks that I'll make for... Yeah, the big one I notice is, yeah, for me, I'm quite a, if I have several negative days in a row where I'm just, and I know what that's like, I'm bitter and I'm irritable and every little stress gets me swearing to myself instead of going, oh, well, that happened. So, you know, and again, I think sometimes it's just a bit of normal moodiness. But if you see the pattern coming.
Okay,
that's a bit of...
It's self-aware as well.
Yeah, fantastic. That's right.
Whereas with having bipolar and being a parent or a father, a child on the spectrum, how do you manage that then?
With a lot of, again, heaps and heaps of work at managing my own. So the first thing was, so as I say, my daughter's 21 and... Up until late adolescence, where her bipolar stuff started to appear, she was a dream kid, and she was so. I'm a talker. I'm very verbal. She's very verbal. I learnt to read early, and I could discuss abstract concepts early. My daughter was the same. So from the youngest age, 4 years old, I could sit down with her and have a, you know, not just a conversation about don't be mean to people, but we could talk about the philosophy and kind of sociology of why you don't be mean to people. So in a sense, I had this false sense of what an amazing father I am because my daughter was so emotionally intelligent and kind of linguistically capable of understanding like really abstract concepts at a young age. So, you know, so in many ways she was quote unquote a great kid that everyone sort of remarked on how emotionally mature she was and whatever else. And I was like, yes, acing it. Then Obi came along and once about 3 years old where his diagnosis and challenges became very clear, the biggest thing for me to get past was to go, I know nothing about parenting this kid. every instinct I have because I'm such a verbal person and I want to explain everything to everyone, which was just pointless for him. Like, so that's one thing, just daily going, I'm just a student here. I'm just making it up. Not making it up, making choices based on my observation and learning.
Learning as we go. So
yeah,
true.
I mean, and also, you know, reading everything I can and whatever else. But even then, you know, you can't, I mean, you would know, kids on the spectrum, you can't take one fit of, you know, approaches or models. So certain things you can learn and, you know, good therapists will teach you strategies and whatever else, but you've got to try stuff. That doesn't work, throw that away or take this piece of that. And But for me, it's all about, I've had to completely relearn how I relate to a person, how I help them calm down, and even in my own regulation. So in the past, you know, with a family member or taking care of kids. Like I used to work in residential youth work, for example, with a bunch of teenage boys, and they would push your buttons and whatever else. And so for me, that was always vocal, though. You know, I would kind of do to them the big scary dad voice of like, right, any more of that, and I'm going to lose my rag. And in a sense, saying here's the line between me being growling at you and me getting proper angry and like shouting and getting scary at you. And, you know, I'm a big guy with a deep voice, and that would work, right? And I would have expressed enough of my anger and frustration that I'd be able to keep myself in check as well. So in a sense, it's a bit of a stamp of the foot and everyone behaves and like, good, right. That will not help with Obi. So in a sense, I can't even engage the – so any attempt to control him is generally a terrible idea, full stop. And any attempt to control him with any emotional kind of weight or any – to expect compliance from him, no. And to and to try and dominate him, no, he's way too strong and he's completely oblivious to all that. So, you know, I am much better off getting down to his level, you know, taking the sharp knife out of his hand, you know, while sort of speaking to him soothingly and saying, you know, I'm sorry, that's you can't have it. That's a lie, you know, and so in a sense, you're still parenting, you're still intervening and stopping the kid from doing the dangerous thing or the whatever else, but it's also picking your battles too. Yeah. Like, you know, if he wants to, it's just a case of going, well, no, you can't pour water all over the kitchen floor, you can't go pour it all over the patio or whatever and just like go make a mess out there and
experiment there.
Yeah, exactly.
Science is good.
yeah, totally. So I'm actually in many ways hardest thing I've ever done parenting him. On the other hand, one of the most amazing learnings too, because I've had to go, I'm a person who's pretty confident about being a pretty quick learner and pretty intelligent, and most things I try I can pick up fairly quickly. With Obi, no, I'm just every day is, it's not day one, because, you know, I'm learning as I go, but I'm not, yeah. Yeah, it's just a kind of a really powerful humility.
Yeah, I've definitely felt the same with my boys. They are polar opposites on the spectrum, and one is very compliant and very, you know, rule driven and very rigid, and the other one is totally opposite that and very, you know, defiant. And I've had to learn to definitely keep my own emotions in check, and I've definitely had to, they're my best teachers. I love these kids to pieces. And then I have a neurotypical son as well who gets really hypo. But, you know, and even trying to teach him and help him to navigate autism, because doesn't understand the differences. And he does, you know, so I've got him into a course coming up next term with Clinic Kids, and it's for siblings that are on the spectrum.
Oh, brilliant.
I know. I'm so excited. He is excited. He's going to do it. I've explained what's going to happen in it, and he said, Mum, this sounds great. He's 10.
Oh, so, that's amazing.
Yeah. So he's got a lot of emotional awareness, and his brothers are fantastic. But I want him to, you know, understand our family dynamic is our unique family dynamic. And, you know, some of the stuff that they do, he's not going to see out there, but it means that he is more empathetic and more understanding of other people's, you know, normals. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's amazing. And you know, yeah, I just want to say to you, strength your arm too, because the idea of, you know, my two kids are 15 years apart, so I never even really parented like kids at the same time, sort of thing. So I kind of, in a sense, you know, raise two only children who love each other and have a relationship, but, like, you know, it sort of was never under the one roof at the one time. But, yeah, having three kids full stop, like three neurotypical kids, I reckon. I look at people doing that and I go, whoa. Let alone, you know, yeah, two of them on the spectrum and with different kind of expressions of that too, and individual personalities. It must just be, in a sense, yeah, there must be a fair bit of, I just imagine myself in that situation going, there would be a lot of constant considering of decisions in my head, like in the moment. Does that ring true?
It's okay. One of them is going to a special education school now, and that's probably the hardest thing that has happened for me because of the travelling time and because of how much he resists it, which emotionally has been draining me.
I bet.
And I, you know, if he was happy, I'd be like, yep, just suck it up. But it takes, so it's about 11 hours a week in travelling for me to get to and from school. And that's because he mucks around a lot. Yeah. It really should be 9 hours. I'm really lucky because I am a single mum and his dad and I are very amicable. We co-parent really, really well. So. Brilliant. I can go to his dad or their dad and say, you know, look, I need you to come in as the dad. Yeah. And he will. He comes in and he's like, no, this is this. And we do. We communicate really well together. And that, I think, helps having that supportive relationship for the boys. They know that both mum and dad love them. And, their dad and I attend meetings together. We try to always be on the same page, which is really great.
So good.
Yeah, it is really good. So, yeah, but it's a learning curve and I feel like I never quite get it right for my middle son. I feel like I'm like constantly reevaluating, constantly thinking, okay, I've got it right, and then I go, oh, no, I haven't. I'm back on the merry-go-round.
Yeah. It's hard. It's really, really hard.
Yeah. It is hard. And I can't even imagine having, you know, something like bipolar, because I go through a lot of emotions with what, you know, having two children on the spectrum, and then with my son with mental health stuff. I can't imagine having bipolar and trying to navigate that, especially if you have big highs or lows, but in the low part when, you know, trying to navigate that, it's tough.
It is tough, but maybe in some ways, and I don't know, because our own experience is normative for us, right? So we never really know. But in some ways, maybe there's a bit of a gift in it in terms of, so for example, if a person has chronic asthma, they know their limits, right? They know I can't hang around that group of smokers in the corner and have a chat with them, even though they seem like really cool people and want to talk to them, because if I get a belly full of passive smoke, then it's going to, you know. So in a sense for me, and it probably makes it hard to be, you know, in relationship with me or whatever else. I know it's difficult. Obi's mum and I, you know, there's probably a reason we didn't work out as partners, because we both have our own stuff going on. And for me, I'm someone who has to pull my own parachute quickly. And so because I know for me, my emotions spilling over, you know, I can only go so far. I'm pretty good. I can go a fair way. The elastic band can go a long way, but I will call it long before it snaps, just because I know for me, my emotions spilling over could become, in a sense, days and days of being unwell and of no help to anybody. And effectively, to be dramatic about it, because it's bipolar type 1 disorder, in a sense, letting my emotions get away from me could result in a morbid depression. It could result that ultimately has fatal consequences. I mean, that's the reality. Like, that's, you know, 47% of people with bipolar 1, you know, end their own lives prematurely. That's just a thing. So as much as I'm absolutely resolved and committed, that's not going to happen to me. Like, you know, the stats say it's a risk. And at the other end of the scale is mania, at which point, you know, like, I've experienced the inside of a psychiatric hospital as an involuntary patient, and that to me is actually a worse thing than dying, like just having your freedom and agency taken away from you. So, yeah, so I guess, so, yeah, sorry.
Sorry, with that, you just said that calling it early.
Yeah.
What are the signs for you then?
It's usually a combination of a sustained emotional feeling with either, more often, an overwhelming sense of exhaustion and tiredness. And that's pretty normal for anybody, right? If you've had a hard day with your kids or at work or whatever else, and you might be in a really shitty mood where you want to yell and swear at everybody and you also feel exhausted, right? You want to tell everyone to go away. I get an intense version of that where I call it an emotional hangover, where my head starts to hurt, where like I it's just it just feels really bad, and I have to call it early for me. Even though I'm acknowledging this might just be tiredness meets irritability meets, you know, maybe all I need is a, you know, is a bath and a good night's sleep and, you know, a bit of self-care and I'll be good. But I also know that could be I do that too long. Like I do that several times over the course of, and we have those periods of life, right, where it's just full on, right? And we feel that way regularly. And I know for me in the past, it's just a crapshoot for me. It's a punt. I might get through it like anyone does and come out the other side going, that was a horrible bloody month. I was just stressed and exhausted the whole time and, you know, I feel like I barely got through it. Or that could be if I don't take absolute steps to address that, and that might mean doing something that really pisses people off, taking 2 weeks off work or, you know, just letting people down, like, you know. Yeah, I've got to be absolutely unashamed in kind of putting myself first then.
Yeah, you know? Self-care is really important.
Yeah, well, it is. But particularly, though, when it's self-care that's kind of, you know, I mean, that's hard to your kid's other parent, on the kid themselves, on the people who rely on you, like, you know. I once had a social worker tell me, or no, a psychologist, I'm sorry, tell me that, you know, you have a significant psychosocial disability and you should never aspire to work more than 3 days a week. And, you know, because you'll need the rest.
Why did they impose that limitation on you, Bart?
They just thought that was the healthy, they just thought, you know, basically that you'll need that much extra time and space in your life to kind of accommodate your, you know, your needs and your management and staying healthy and whatever else. And I hear that. I actually reckon, you know, I often say to people bipolar type 1 is a part-time job, the management of it, and I do devote some time and attention to it every day. But it's worth it. Like it's you know.
So does that suit you, that, you know, that part-time sort of, but is that so that you manage?
Sorry to interrupt, but I just, for me, what's the most likely thing is a sense of purpose.
Okay.
And for right or wrong, it's probably a very boring thing for a man to say, but I find my purpose in work, in meaningful work. And so for me, that's, you know, it's a lot of stuff about teaching and connecting and mentoring and advocacy and all those things. So when I feel like I'm using my gifts in a way that is meaningful and productive and whatever else, that's the best thing I can do for self-care.
Yeah.
Which is a slippery slope, right? Because you go down that line too long and you start to fall into workaholism. So that can also go wrong in terms of self-care. And I know there are times. I've got an amazing professional supervisor. She's so good. She will occasionally say to me, are you working too much? You know, when's your next, you know, leave planned or your next time off or your next, you know, and I'm like, oh, I've got a bunch of projects that are really important right now and they're all so close. And she's like, no, well, what happens if, you know, you put them all down? Anyways, she's amazing. And I can go down that road because it is very life-giving to me to feel like, you know.
Yeah.
So that is part of self-care for me. I like to, I hate, one of the things I hate about depression is feeling like I'm just wasting, just burning time, because don't get me wrong, I love mindfulness, I love consciously resting, good, healthy, productive, regenerative resting. I love that. I mean, I love going out to the bush and just sitting around 2 days staring at fires and kind of, you know, getting in touch with myself and, you know, all the kind of in reading books and, you know, feeling all spiritual and all that kind of stuff that we do when we come back going, yeah, refreshed. I love that. But the thing about depression for me that I hate is I feel like I'm taking all the time out and getting none of the good stuff like that. And to me, productive work is the opposite of that.
Like it's, yeah.
Yeah. Mind you, I hate wasting time, full stop. Working in a job I hate, oh, God. there's many, many shitty jobs I've done in my life and just gone, what am I doing here? Like, you know.
I like to help people in that space. A few people have said to me exactly that. And I look at them and I go, you know what? Why are you staying in it? And I love all the responses, oh, money, this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you know what? You are denying someone else their passion by staying in this job.
It's beautiful.
And it makes them stop and go, whoa, and move on. If you're not happy in a role, please, please go and find your passion and allow someone else their passion by doing that role.
I love it.
Yeah, it's a good way to shift it, isn't it?
It's a really good way. And I just, yeah, it's It's funny because I'm wary of that phrase wasting time, because I feel like when people say that, it implies everyone's, you know, the idolatry of being busy or go, and that's, I think that's an unhealthy way to live. But for me, I just, maybe it's growing up on a farm, maybe a sense of no, the rain's fallen, we need to till that soil, you know, and you know, like I. Yeah, if I'm standing still, it's because I'm choosing to stand still and enjoy it and get something out of it. But if I'm standing still kind of too long, it's like, well, why? What's, there's something around the next corner. There's something around, the, you know, something over that next hill or something, you know. So, yeah.
With your mental health journey, you're about to branch more into that, aren't you? Like,
I'm going full-time with it, yeah. So I've had a kind of community role that's been focused in one spot, whereas I'm now I'm transitioning slowly towards focusing my work, having one job, besides a bit of freelance stuff and comedy and yada yada, but one employer through Evolve WA, specifically doing, you know, training and teaching and advocacy stuff. So, you know.
Terrific. We're about to wrap up, but if you wanted to leave everyone with a mental health message, what would it be?
Wow. Gee, that's
I know,
pressure.
It's big, isn't it?
It's pressure.
All right. You can hone it down more and more and more as even a parent or someone that has bipolar. Like, what's a nice message for parents?
Look, I'm gonna be very general here. If you reckon there might be anything up with you, by which I mean, you know, if you've had a history of whatever it is, you know, depression, a bit of anxiety, like, you know, whatever it is, like you know, you, if something is deeply dissatisfying, if you just suspect, oh, God, what's wrong with me? If that's eating at your self-esteem somewhere, go down a journey of diagnosis. I think the world is a little over-pathologized and a little over-diagnosed, but I tell you what, if you find out there's a thing going on with your neurology or some physical condition you didn't know about or some hormone imbalance or some whatever, a learning disability you never understood, whatever it is, like tell you what, finding that out can save your life and be the beginning of kind of, yeah, of kind of fulfillment. So that's my, yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Russell. Thanks so much for joining us as well. So, Wurzel, where can people find you on socials as well?
Well, that's a really good question. Look, I'm barely on the socials. You could tell you what, you can find me on Instagram under That Mozza, at That Mozza. that's a good place to start.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us, Wurzel. You've been listening to Yvonne and Wurzel from Bounce Back.